Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Cabrilla Bumgardner. Dr. Bumgardner is an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Hampshire. Her work focuses on social and political realities that have shaped African-American activism in the 19th and 20th centuries, and she's the author of the book In Pursuit of Knowledge, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. Dr. Bumgardner, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start by asking you, what motivated you to study educational activism in the northern part of Antebellum America? And what in particular inspired you to focus on the educational experience of Black women?
Perhaps I was sort of predisposed to study the subject of Black women's educational activism because of my own experiences, having watched my mother return to college in her mid-30s and seeing how she then encouraged my own intellectual growth, particularly in middle school and high school. She believed very strongly in learning and teaching and seeking knowledge. And that always stayed with me. And then when I got to graduate school, I started to examine the experiences and the actions and ideas of young Black women as knowledge seekers. And I wanted to explore their enthusiasm, really, for learning and for their strong sense of curiosity. And this was an opportunity in my dissertation work and then in this book to sort of like unpack that. What does it mean to be a knowledge seeker, right? What does it mean for Black women to be ambitious, to be thoughtful, and to articulate the sort of desire for intellectual sustenance, right? And that was something I explored, and it was just great to sort of write about that in this book.
So one of the things I was so impressed by was the level of detail that you're able to describe each of the individuals that you highlight in your book. But you also, at the beginning, highlight how challenging it was to find this information through archives. So why did this create a challenge for you? And how more broadly does this create a challenge for historical work focused on uncovering the stories of historically marginalized and minoritized groups?
It's an excellent question. In this book, I draw upon a range of sources. I, cite petitions and newspaper articles, census records, school catalogs, court transcripts. So I tried to use as many different sources as I could, but it was a challenge trying to track them all down for a lot of reasons. One reason, sometimes the finding aid for a particular collection is incomplete, or perhaps maybe the finding aid was written 20 years ago and there isn't the kind of detail that you want that might talk about, let's say in my case, African-American women. So I actually ended up finding a fascinating collection at Bowling Green that detailed Black women's experiences at a seminary in upstate New York. And the finding aid says nothing about that. So you have to go there, look through those records and hope, that there's something there. And there was. There's also another challenge in that documents related to Black women's lived experiences were just not archived. So many repositories didn't deem it important or worthy to collect documents related to Black girls and women. So I agree with you that the historical work to uncover the stories of Black women and other minoritized groups becomes that much more challenging. But I do hold on to this notion of archival optimism, which I wrote about in an article I published in the History of Education Quarterly. And I believe in sort of focusing on the documents that are there in a particular collection and working through those and then using maybe various databases to try to delve deeper. And I would also say, don't underestimate the power of Google. Right. So I ended up Googling the name of one of the seminaries that I studied in the book, the Young Ladies Domestic Seminary. And I was able to purchase a letter written by a white woman student who attended that seminary at the same time that the Black woman attended the seminary. And even though the letter doesn't mention the Black woman students, it provides really important detail of the day-to-day activities of students at the seminary. And I believe the letter cost me like $30. So I have I have my own kind of, you know, archive in some ways, this one letter, and it provided necessary context to think about Black women's experiences, right? Attending classes, eating meals together, attending social events. And that information just helped me write, you know, that's, I believe, the third chapter in the book or second chapter in the book. It was just better for me to explain that seminary with that kind of detail. And I still have the letter. So it's a reminder that you might find sources where you least expect it.
So you titled your book In Pursuit of Knowledge, but you start the book by highlighting purposeful womanhood in the educational experience of Black women. So how do you define purposeful womanhood? And what role did you find it played in the educational experience of Black women and children?
So there's a powerful quote from Sarah Mapps Douglas that I share at the beginning of the book. And Douglas was writing to African-American girls and women who were thinking about attending Prudence Crandall Seminary in Canterbury, Connecticut. And Douglas said, "Be courageous, put your trust in the God of the oppressed and go forward." And I really liked this idea of going forward and moving forward. And I found that that's exactly what young Black women did. They went forward even amid violence, amid harassment, racial abuse, you know, the unknown, because some of these women, at least in the context of Canterbury, Connecticut, were from New York City or even from Philadelphia. So they were going into a town that they knew nothing about, but they went forward anyway. And I wanted to know why, right? Why did they go forward? Why did they pursue education? And I found that from their writings, young Black women viewed education, specifically schooling and teaching, as a way to live their purpose. So these women were purposeful. And by that, I mean they were resilient, they were resourceful, and they were forward thinking. And they really truly believed that they had an obligation to acquire knowledge for themselves and then to pass that on to Black children, Black youth, Black adults. So they went forward. And some women like Sarah Mapps Douglas dedicated their entire lives to teaching African-American children. Others like Rosetta Morrison pursued advanced education. And then as a mother, she instilled in her children the value of education. But no matter the path they pursued, these Black women held on to this idea of living their purpose through education.
That's one of the things I really appreciated about your book, how when you finally finish the book, you come to realize that what you're really telling is a story of progress, but a progress that has various points, various catalysts throughout the story. And there are individuals who are paving the way for other individuals that are coming that they don't know, but you're weaving it inside and out. And I think that history is such a beautiful way to describe how others are setting the path forward. So I want to ask you about why you started by writing about the experience of Sarah Harris and Prudence Crandall and the Canterbury Female Seminary. Why was that an important place for you to start to tell this story about Black women activism?
It was, a watershed moment in the history of Black women's activism. If we think about sort of the larger history of the female seminary movement, so, you know, a little bit about that. The Canterbury Female Seminary for young Black women was part of this larger female seminary movement. And that movement emerged in the late 18th century, but it really took hold in the 19th century. So the historian Mary Kelly estimates that there were at least 350 female seminaries in the United States by the 1860s. So this is a huge educational movement. And these seminaries serve mostly white, middle class, and elite women. They were around the age of sometimes 12 to 18. And some historians have found that these seminaries were on par with male colleges. So it was really groundbreaking for Prudence Crandall to establish a seminary just for Black women in 1833. And she did so because of Sarah Harris. She was a young Black woman who wanted to go to the seminary so she could train to become a teacher. And that really pulled, you know, Prudence Crandall into the abolition movement. It pulled her into, you know, a deeper understanding of Black women's education. And so I argue in the book that this was a watershed moment because it really demonstrated Black women's educational ambition, right? Their pursuit of knowledge. And that was really, really critical. And then, of course, the controversy that followed also made it a really, you know, important story. Through the seminary, I was also able to identify a broader story of Black women's activism in schooling and teaching, and I found that it was interconnected. So there were lots of Black women fighting for their educational rights, and instead of Sarah Harris standing alone, you know, my book links her to other Black women like Maria Stewart, or I should say Mariah Stewart, one of the first Black women to speak in public, one of the first women really to speak, American women to speak in public. I'm able to connect Sarah Harris to Maricha Lyons, who desegregated Providence High School in the 1860s. There are ways in which these Black women are part of a network. And I think earlier studies hadn't really teased that out. And it's not easy to do because of the, you know, lack of sources, but that was one thing I wanted to demonstrate in this book, that these women were part of a network and they were, you know, supporting each other and encouraging each other to pursue education.
I'm curious, how did Black women communicate in antebellum America?
Right. So that was really incredible to come across some of these letters that Black women exchanged. And if I couldn't find sometimes letters that they exchanged with each other, I found letters where they talked about exchanging letters with each other. Serena DeGrasse, for example, wrote to her teacher and she described her communications with Mary Miles, who would become Mary Miles Bibb. Serena DeGrasse would give updates on some of the other Black women students who were at the school, at the Young Ladies Domestic Seminary. So through those letters, I was able to trace that these women knew each other and that they were friends and that those friendships lasted over their entire lives, right? They were decades long friendships. And that part is again missing in some of these earlier stories of Black women because it's just not easy to find. It's not easy to see. But letters became a really great way for me to kind of get at this network of Black women and the way they communicated.
So you also write about the various ways in which white Northerners resisted trends towards increased education for Black children, especially young Black girls. And as I read your book, I couldn't help but think about some of the ways our democracy has been tested in recent years and in recent days. So what actions did you find white Northerners took to prevent Black girls from receiving an education?
So yes, many white Northerners intentionally got in the way of Black women's pursuit of education. They excluded Black women from seminaries and high schools, public high schools. They expelled Black girls from schools or they ostracized them. In the book, I talk about Sarah Parker Raimond, who attended a high school, the East School for Girls. And, you know, no sooner than she had arrived, the principal, her teacher, told her that she was going to be expelled because the city of Salem, the residents of Salem, no longer wanted her at that high school. So there are multiple examples of Black girls being expelled because of their race. There was no other reason. We also see white Northerners passing racist exclusionary laws. Connecticut is the example. Because Prudence Crandall established her seminary for Black women, the state of Connecticut passed the so-called Black Law that forbade Black children from out of state to attend a school in Connecticut. In some cases, white Northerners even attacked Black students and their schools. So in the book, I document quite a few instances in Ohio and in the Midwest, but there were examples in New England as well. The Canterbury Female Seminary was attacked. The Noyes Academy was attacked in Canaan, New Hampshire. There was a school teacher by the name of, I think, Giles Buckingham, and that school was attacked. That teacher was attacked. There are many incidents in New England, in the Midwest, where schools were attacked, schools for Black children were attacked. So amid this violence, you know, this racial abuse, African-American children and their parents had to, you know, decide, are we going to send our child to school, and what's going to happen to them? So there was definitely a lot of trepidation, a lot of anxiety. But again, you know, these Black girls and women went forward anyway.
So how did they? How did women and other activists respond?
So in the book, I document the efforts of Black girls and women as activists, really. They were encouraged to go forward, and so they did. They provided constant support to each other. They also began to define their own sense of activism, which was really incredible for me to trace in this book. The young women, young Black women at Canterbury, for instance, they started to advocate this idea of an ethic of Christian love. And they did that as a way to stave off white violence and to advance their own educational interests. So that was really interesting to see that response to white violence. In the aftermath of the Crandall controversy, I find that Black women adopted a range of protest strategies. So in the book, I talk about their, you know, work writing editorials, right? Talking about the power of education. They petitioned school committees, particularly for public schools and public high schools. They petitioned to be admitted. They boycotted schools. You see that in Salem and in Boston. And they also filed lawsuits. So there was a father, Absalom Boston, in Nantucket, who filed a lawsuit on behalf of his daughter, Phoebe Boston. So you can see that the range of, you know, the range of protest strategies that they pursued, you know, and that was sort of connected to their own, I want to say, internal ideas of their worth, right, of their equality. Sometimes what's, you know, kind of sad about this is that, as you mentioned this earlier, there were so many of these Black girls and women pushing to get into schools that some of them were not able to take advantage of the opportunities they had eventually opened, right? It would be the next generation who would benefit from those opportunities. And that's, you know, that's a sad part of this, that they spent their whole time trying to fight to get into schools that sometimes they never actually got to go.
So we talked a little bit earlier about how, what's really nice about your book is the way that it highlights individuals who paved the way for students that they don't know are coming yet, but they're doing the work anyways. So how did Black women who attended female seminaries early in antebellum America pave the way for later generations of students?
You know, I think maybe the story of Joanna Turpin Howard kind of embodies this. So her father was enslaved and he was freed. And interestingly, her father's owner ended up giving the father money for his labor. He was sort of converted to abolition, the slave owner. And that allowed Joanna's father to send Joanna and her siblings to school. And Joanna herself attended the Young Ladies Domestic Seminary. So she was in this interracial environment, right, studying alongside white women. But this was very much an abolitionist school. It was run by Hiram Kellogg. And he imparted these abolitionist values to his students. It's quite possible not all of them, you know, imbibed those values, but it was there, right? It was circulating at that seminary. And I believe that that was an important moment for Joanna, not just because she got an opportunity to experience this advanced education, but I think it also sort of prepared her for when she moved to Boston to participate in the Boston Equal School Rights campaign. And essentially, equal school rights meant trying to secure a quality education for Black children, regardless of race. And you see the movement emerge in Massachusetts, but also in Connecticut. There are even discussions of desegregating schools in places like New Hampshire. And at least in the Boston fight, Joanna was one of those Black women who was right there lobbying the school committee, circulating the petitions so that people in the Black community would sign it in order to desegregate Boston public schools. And so I do believe that there's a connection to her having attended an interracial seminary that then prepared her to enter the fight for equal school rights in Boston. And they were successful. So in 1855, essentially, Boston public schools were integrated. So there was victory in many times in the activism and work that these Black women engaged in.
So there's been work on the educational experience of Blacks in the South. For example, James Anderson's work, which is everything after the Civil War. Was there any communication between the experience of Blacks in the North and the South?
That's a great question. When I started this book, I originally thought I could write a history of Black women's educational activism in the 19th century United States. And as I started working on this, I realized there was a regional story here, a really important regional story that I certainly wanted to connect to the South and, you know, connect to the West. But I found that there needs to be more work there, right? There needs to be more work in thinking about free Black communities in the South and how those communities educated their children and youth. And I think there's a similar story to be told out West. I read a lot about Black women in San Francisco who were establishing schools for Black children. So you find the stories are there. And I just think there's more research that needs to be done. But certainly there had to be communication. There had to be, strategizing. But the context is going to be different, right? Because of slavery. So I think that's it's a worthy pursuit, for research, for a researcher to take up.
So I want to conclude by asking you about the role character education played in the classrooms of Black teachers and students. So how do you define character education and what role did it play?
Character education in the 19th century United States focused on moral and intellectual development. And I think it was a critical aspect of public school instruction. My chapter in the book explores how Black women teachers viewed and defined character education. And I was particularly taken with the story of Susan Paul, whose father was Thomas Paul. He was a religious leader in Boston, in central part of the Black community in Boston. And her mother, by the way, was also a teacher. So she was raised in this really, you know, interesting environment. And she becomes a teacher too. Susan Paul becomes a teacher. And I found that she really wove character education into her pedagogy. And you probably see this more in her book, The Memoir of James Jackson, which is about one of her students. He was 6 and a half and he died. And she really talks about character education and teaching in that book. I believe that she thought that character education would prepare Black children to become good and purposeful members of society who would then better the nation. And so she and other teachers, I talk about Ann Plato, I talk about Sarah Mapps Douglas, they really schooled children in these subjects that we teach today, you know, English grammar and arithmetic and geography and history. But they did so while stressing values such as kindness and industry and integrity and self-discipline. And I do think that had a great impact on Black children and youth who were in their classrooms.
Thank you, Dr. Baumgartner. Again, her book is entitled In Pursuit of Knowledge, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. Next month, we'll be speaking with Drs. Bruce Baker and Preston Green about issues related to school finance and school choice. Dr. Baker is a professor in the Department of Educational Theory, Policy, and Administration at the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers University, and Dr. Green is the John and Maria Neag Professor of Urban Education at the Neag School of Education at the University of Connecticut. As always, thanks for listening. We hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis of education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.